Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the mega city metropolis of Toronto. I am your host. This is episode 204, and returning back to the show is one of my favorite guests to have on the show. We have a lot of fun whenever we do one of these chatting with Chapmans, and I guess I spoiled it. It's Mr. Adam Chapman. Adam, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I always love the intros. I'm always filled with glee that someone describes me thusly, but I appreciate it very much.
The world-famous podcaster. Yeah, the world-famous podcaster, Adam Chapman. For those who haven't checked out his show, I plug it frequently on mine, but you definitely got to go and check out his latest episodes because you've had some pretty great guests on there.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, we had Jed Winnick come back, but I think the big one that was very exciting—I know you were excited about—was Roger Stern. It's like I was able to coax him out of hiding, and we had an amazing conversation. I can't tell you how much fun it was. It was just such a pleasure to be able to talk with someone of his, you know, immense creative prowess, and he did not disappoint. He was such a consummate storyteller, not just in print or with the written word, but also with the spoken word. He grabbed my attention. He just kind of ran with it. I feel like sometimes I was like, I didn't even ask a question. Like, we're just letting this fly, and it was awesome. So, yeah, please check out the most recent episodes of Comic Shenanigans. You will not be disappointed.
That's great. So I know it's been not that long since you've been on the show, but you've had a – as everybody's had a questionable 2020, to say the least. It's been, you know, every month there's something new that seems to be happening. I wanted to say over the show, congratulations to you and your family for the latest edition that you guys have.
Thank you.
And it's always very refreshing to see people have joyful things happening to them amongst all of the constant bad news we seem to be getting and putting on our timelines. It's really nice to see happy things happening for families. So congratulations to you and Kelly and Zach and welcoming little Olivia to the family.
Thank you. Yeah, for those who don't know, my wife and I have recently adopted a little girl. She's almost 17 months now. It's such a weird thing to have happen in the middle of a pandemic to kind of find out, you're going to be, you know, you get to take care of this beautiful little girl and add her to your family. And it is interesting that, as you say, like in the middle of all this horrible bad news, now I have this, you know, bright spot. And so when I tell people through my work, et cetera, and I'm just like, oh, you know, because everyone always asks you, you know, what's new? And I'm like, well, we just adopted this little girl. And everyone, I guess it's because everyone's so used to so much bad news these days. Everyone is extra excited and happy. They're like, oh my God, that's great news. It's so nice to hear good news once in a while. And I'm like, that's nice.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I think sometimes we don't share enough of the simple things, the simple happy things in life that bring us joy, because we feel like we've got to always be looking for the next thing to worry about. But I get really excited when I see you guys post pictures with the family doing stuff right now, because everyone's posting something about, I don't know, you name it. And it's just you get exhausted. So that's good. I like that.
Yeah, we like to keep it light, you know, like, as you said, there's so much depressing stuff out there, and I'm not really someone who typically posts a lot of that type of stuff, but it's nice to have something, some happiness, you know.
Definitely.
Not everything is always going to be doom and gloom. There's a lot of it out there, but, you know, there's also some good stuff. You just have to find the happy things and celebrate those, and I guess that's kind of what we're doing today. We're celebrating some of our most binge-worthy books, right?
Absolutely. Great segue. See, that's good hosting right there. I'm going to just let you take away the show. That's good.
It's funny because I was like, oh, I'm totally stepping on his host toes, but it's such a great setup that I feel like I have to do it.
No, it's perfect. I love it. So the last time we did a comics binge-worthy reading episode, it was in 2018, near the end of 2018. So I think we're well overdue for one of these episodes. But to refresh the listener's memory, or even mine, how do you decide what's considered binge-worthy? Because I asked that because for me, when I was thinking about my list, I had a hard time with it because I basically binge-read all my comics because I'm a trade waiter. I'm that horrible person that comic shops hate. So everything I read is I binge it. So I was like, okay, what's actually binge-worthy? Well, in my shelf, seems like everything is, but how would you describe it for you?
You know, a big part of it for me came down to the length of the book, or how many issues, and if there was, you know, like, for me, like, 6 issues isn't really a binge. Like, you know, it had to be 12 issues plus, or if not more. There's one kind of exception on my list, but I feel like given this, you know, given what the material is, I think it still counts as binge-worthy. But I think typically that's been something for me, is it something that, first of all, is going to grab your attention more often than not by one creative voice or one artist. Not always, not exclusively, but generally speaking, and over a duration. Now, I found that because of how comics are done these days, there's a lot of books that, you know, start and then they stop, and they go about a year and a half. They go about that 17, 18 issue mark, and then we're getting these complete collections of these books, and I would say that's actually perfectly binge-worthy. Like, they're giving you just enough, you know, they're giving you more than just six to 12 issues. You're getting a little bit more depth in there. You're getting more content. But it's still tidy. And it's, again, one kind of full story or one narrative voice doing it. Whereas back in the day, you wouldn't really get that. You'd, you know, have creators jumping on and off, and you'd have more flux. Whereas I feel like you don't get that as much these days, which for the person trying to kind of come up with perfect kind of binge worthy books, you have more of consistency. I don't know if that helps or answers the question at all.
No, it totally does. Cause I was thinking of that myself. I'm like, does 12 issues count as a binge-worthy book? And we make the rules ourselves, right? There's no rules to this. But I'm like, does it got to be a run of 25 issues that you read at once? Like, what are the things that, you know, make us come to those conclusions? So I wanted to kind of refresh the rules or the standards that we're going by, because it, I don't know, it kind of helps you curate your list or even add something to it, because you're like, oh, 12 issue book, I'm going to put that one on there now. So, okay. So something that 12 issues plus, somewhat of a singular vision, and you get into it and you just don't put it down.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds pretty fair. Now, I will – we talked about this kind of off podcast, but last time I think because I'm me and I sometimes make myself do more difficult things for no reason, I really pushed myself last time to, you know, make it more even between publishers. I was trying to be like, okay, let's get like an Image, a Marvel, DC. I had like Archie in there from Archie Comics. Like, I was really doing everything I could to make it as diverse as possible and kind of different and offbeat. This time I did not do that. This time I just kind of said – so much on my shelf could probably be, you know, the winner for this, but I just kind of was looking through a bunch of stuff. One of the books I actually sat down reading. I recently bought it finally, after years of thinking about it, and I have not been able to put it down all day. I've been sneaking time away at every moment to read it, and I was like, oh, maybe I can finish it before this podcast so I can really have it all in there. I didn't quite finish, but for me, it definitely earned its place as being a binge-worthy book because I could not put it down. It was just as exciting as I remembered it, and I cannot wait to finish it later today.
Okay, so with that said, why don't you start us off and take it away, and I hope the first one is the one that you were just talking about.
Oh, no, I'm saving it for the end. No, Eric.
All right.
You are not getting this right off the hop. All right. No, you gotta wade all the way into the episode to get this one.
2 hours later.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. No, so I will start with something else a little bit different. So I'm going to talk about a book that is a relatively recent purchase for me. It was something that I never really followed, but then for the last 10, 15 years, I definitely heard a lot about this creator's work, and it was something that I always kind of wanted to check out, but it was kind of off the beaten path for me. It wasn't something that would typical. It wasn't superheroes. It was just kind of different. And I'd always heard about it, and I always heard about how amazing his work was, this particular creator. And then finally, his opus, the best work that, you know, many people say he ever did, or the crowning achievement of his career, was put into a slipcase. First, it came out with one volume, then two later. I bought volume one separately, and then later the price of the slipcase was so good, I just bought the slipcase. So I actually have volume one twice. So I'm speaking about The Complete Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck, by Fantagraphics, and it's, well, sorry, published by Fantagraphics, but it was originally the singular vision of Don Rosa. So Don Rosa, an immensely talented cartoonist, so it's interesting, he would not call himself such. He thinks that he is a pretender to the throne, and that the real, the best person to ever illustrate Scrooge and Donald Duck is Carl Barks. A lot of people might agree with that. But Don Rosa is a huge fan of Carl Barks, and so when he got the, you know, chance to actually do Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck comics, he was trying to pay homage to to everything that Karl Barks had done. So the crowning achievement of that is what makes up The Complete Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck, which was originally published in different installments and then was finally put in chronological order in this two-volume set, kind of. The original versions of it are actually in Volume 1, and then he did other kind of untold stories that go in between the original chapters, which are make up Volume 2. But he didn't want them all interspersed together. He wanted the original, you know, volumes that he all put together to be the Volume 1, and then the extra stuff to be Volume 2. So this is his vision. Now, Fantagraphics has done a whole collection of Don Rosa books, but this is collecting just the particular ones that make up The Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck. I've read it with my son. That's part of why I originally bought it. I was like, I've always wanted to read his stories. I never knew where to start because Fantagraphics has a great library, but I never really knew where I should be starting. And then they announced they were finally going to be reprinting The Complete Life and Time. So I was like, you know what? This is the way. So I bought it to read it to my son. He loves it. He's loved both volumes. It's funny. It's epic. It's so much more than you can imagine kind of funny animal comics to be at their root. But he really gets the character of Uncle Scrooge. It's a historical epic. Again, you trace the history of Uncle Scrooge from 1877 all the way to 1947. It's an absolute epic. You get to see an Uncle Scrooge you never thought you would. You only get to see Huey, Dewey, and Louie right at the very end. Like anyone who was raised in the 80s and knows DuckTales, late 80s, early 90s, you know DuckTales. DuckTales wouldn't exist without Karl Barks, but you know that idea of having kind of the adventuring Uncle Scrooge and Donald and Huey, Dewey, and Louie. And this tome is all about how do we get that version of Uncle Scrooge. Now, I think Don Rosa doesn't really like DuckTales and kind of the decisions it made, but it's hard to not look at this and kind of see some similarities. But this is everything you ever wanted to know about Scrooge McDuck, but we're too afraid to ask.
I did not expect a Scrooge McDuck comic listing. That shocked me, and I like it. That's a really cool pick.
So again, there's the, you know, this is the particular one I'm recommending is The Complete Life and Times. It's again, it's available in two volumes. Volume 1 is really the meat of it, and Volume 2 is great, but it makes more sense if you read Volume 1 because again, its stories take place in and around events of Volume 1. But again, supremely enjoyable, definitely binge-worthy. A lot of content here, two beautiful hardcovers. And I thought I'd throw something unexpected before I go down the more pedestrian route.
I like it. Okay. So number one on the list, or the first one you're listing, Scrooge McDuck, The Life and Times. Is that right? Okay. I like it. Very good. The first one that I'm going to list is a 30-issue run from Terry Moore. I'm not gonna have as good of a lead as you have, but it's his particular story of Echo. I told you that I had read this recently during the quarantine when the comic shops and everything was shutting down. It was one of the last purchases I was able to make from my comic shop, and I had always seen it on the shelf there. And I know that Terry Moore is a very well respected master of the comic book art form. And I read parts of Strangers in Paradise. I liked it. I saw what the hype was about from people who were big Terry Moore fans. So I said, let me give this a chance because I want to take a little bit of a break from superhero comics. I want to read something a little bit more of an independent vision because Terry Moore, you know, creates his stories, whole cloth, his little worlds, and he's very, very good at character development. This story, I'll give it just a quick little synopsis from the Wikipedia page. It revolves around Julie, that's the main character, a young photographer who inadvertently discovers a high-tech battle suit. And Terry Moore said that the premise of Echo is a woman living in today's America who is dealing with a sudden and unbelievable change to her daily life. So it sounds very simple. It sounds like something maybe you've heard before. It's like, oh, okay, science fiction. But it's a lot more than that. There's a ton of character development. There's a ton of science involved in it. So if you're a fan of like Oppenheimer and Einstein, there's all these quotes that open up each issue that are very profound quotes from those scientists and the cause and effect of technology and the dangers of where we take it. Because of our inability to fully understand and appreciate the good that we can do with it, we're always thinking of the way to kind of monetize it. and what comes along with that. So it's got all these very, very good, quiet one-on-one moments where people are on the run, scenes where they're just driving in a car or hiding at a hotel. And then you've also got these very big science fiction scenes. So it's a lot of fun. It's all done by Terry Moore, penciled, lettered. It's in black and white. And I'm a guy who I appreciate black and white as anybody else would, because you really see, you know, more of the rawness of it. But I also have a hard time following it in other circumstances. I've read some black and white stuff where I'm like, I'm not appreciating this the way I should. But with Terry Moore, his storytelling's so clear and concise that I couldn't imagine it. Like, in color it would be cool, but I feel like it's perfect just the way it is. So I highly recommend Echo from Terry Moore. So there's my choice off the beaten path that people wouldn't expect, because I'm always known for liking the New 52 or DC Rebirth or something. So that's my pick away from the big two, if you will.
Okay. Well, I'm going to veer us back onto the big two then. Okay. So I was trying to think of a specific DC book or something to talk about with DC, just because, you know, I should throw some love their way. And one book that did come to mind, I ended up not selecting it, but that did come to mind initially, especially because of, you know, obviously his passing recently, was The Question by Denny O'Neill, which is an amazing run, and I have all the trades of that. But I ended up not choosing that. That's an honorable mention because, again, Denny O'Neill recently passed away. It's definitely one of his, you know, more transformative works. And, like, I don't think you can look at the character of The Question the same way because of what he did. He revolutionized that character and changed him forever. And I wonder what would have happened to that character if not for Denny O'Neill. He would not be the character we know today. And that's how transformative that run was. But I'm not going to talk about that, but I just wanted to shout that one out. Nice. But I will say before I go on, have you ever read his Question?
I have not. I have not read it.
It's really good. Now, that being said, I will say, when I first picked up the Question by Denny O'Neill, when they started reprinting the run, I think about 10, 11 years ago, I was a little disappointed at first. And the reason why, and this is no fault of the creators at all, it's that I remember loving The Question as portrayed on the Justice League cartoon. Because he was so cool, so crazy, but, like, so cool. And some of the best moments of the Justice League Unlimited cartoon, in my estimation, are with The Question. He was so interesting and so fascinating. So when I first read The Question by Denny O'Neill, I was like, that's not what this is. What is this? Right. But then I came to really love what Denny O'Neill was doing and how he approached philosophy. And, you know, if you like philosophy in your comics, The Question is where you should go. It's so fascinating, the different kind of areas he takes Dick Sage. So if you haven't tried it, Eric, I do recommend it. It's really interesting. Dennis Cowan's art is very late 80s, early 90s. It's rough, but it needs to be for the character and the story of The Question. It's not super polished looking in terms of looking very, you know, gleaming superhero action. It's dirty, it's rough at times, but it's very fitting to the character and the setting.
Okay. I definitely like philosophy in my comics. I'm a big Jim Starlin fan, so I would check this out.
Okay. So my DC pick, it's kind of an easy pick in a lot of ways. It's definitely, to me, very something I love to read. I feel like I can't just read part of it. I got to read all of it. There was a version of it years ago. I will talk about what it actually is in a second. I remember some people online, I'm not in any way propagating, you know, pirating comics, but it was one of the few times where I'm like, that's a cool idea. I wish DC had actually done that, where they took this particular book and they stripped it down based on the storyline, so you could actually just follow one storyline completely without having to read all the others. So I'm talking about 52. 52 is an amazing book, 52 issues. It was a weekly book. It's spanning a year of all these, in the lives of all these characters. It comes in and out. Certain characters matter, and then they don't, and then they do. Storylines dove in and out. So that was the only thing I liked about this, you know, pirated version that I saw, is they basically said, if you just want to read about Renee Montoya, here's, you know, everything she appeared in for, you know, all 52 issues of just Renee Montoya's storyline. And if you didn't obviously know some of the other things going on, you wouldn't have had all the context. But it was an interesting idea, and I'm kind of curious that, you know, you never really saw that from DC. I mean, why would they? They're basically stripping and ripping apart their own book. It doesn't really make a lot of sense, but I always loved that concept. But 52 in and of itself, it came off after Infinite Crisis. It was this big, big hullabaloo at the time. Oh my God, DC's going to do a weekly book. All these storylines, you know, are going to bounce in and out. They have this creative dream team. They have artists coming in and out through the you know, create consistency. You had Giffen and doing layouts, I believe, so that, again, there was more of a visual consistency. But how is this going to work? And it was just such a big news story that year. And I think the bigger news story is that it worked. It was a phenomenal read. The stories really ended up mattering to those characters. Whether or not it ended up mattering the long term of the DC kind of doesn't matter to me. The fact is, if you read those books, you cared about Renee Montoya, and by the end, you wanted to see what happened to her next. You cared about Booster Gold. You cared about these characters who were not leads of their own, but suddenly they were. In a way that they never, I mean, yes, Booster Gold had had a series before, some of the other characters had too, but they never really felt like leading characters. But coming out of 52, suddenly you had a Booster Gold book, and it was a really top seller, and people loved it. And so that wouldn't have happened before 52, where people started to care about this, about a character like that. So I've always loved it. It's a great exploration of Black Adam as well. So many characters get a really good focus. The most typical characters, like Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, you don't really see them, and that's fine. You get to see so many other characters take the spotlight for a year, and for me, I can't really put it down. You know, you can't just read five issues of 52. You got to read all 52, and then you come out of it. First of all, it's been a while now because you just read 52 issues of comic, but you feel a little better for it because it was such a well-put-together experiment that maybe shouldn't have worked, but it did because Steven Wacker knew what he was doing. And you know that he knew he was what he was doing because the next project, I believe, he wasn't involved with, Countdown, and it didn't work as well. So it's a weekly book that worked, 52 issues. Cannot believe they ever made that work, but they did.
I've read the first 25.
Oh, my God. How did you stop?
I'm not sure what – I started reading the next – I have both volumes of it in those nice big hefty trades.
I don't have those. I have the original four trades.
Yeah. I waited until I could collect it in a very nice, succinct way to read each half of the story. So I'm halfway through it. I have to read the other half. I might just start from the beginning again and read the whole thing. But it was, like you said, it was a very engaging book. There wasn't any parts of it that were a slog to get through. It was fast-paced. All the characters you did care about. And I think that, you know, people – a lot of times people – like that – the aughts for DC was a really, really cool time. Like, they had a lot of good stuff happening, man. And you look back at it, and even between them and Marvel, like, what a great creative era that was for comics. I was shopping again at 1 million and Grey Region, going there every week after work. I didn't know. I remember 52 coming out every week. It just seemed too daunting for me to get into. But I remember that my love for comics was reignited because of everything that seemed to be happening. Like, there were so many things that seemed to matter, and whatever it was that you liked, it was good at the time. Do you know what I mean? Like, Avengers seemed to be good. Spider-Man seemed to be important. Superman was getting like a fresh start with Burt Busiek and Johns, and Batman with Morrison and Green Lantern. Like, the list goes on and on. And it's like all that was happening at the same time. Like, Brubaker on Cap was at that same time. Like, it's so cool. Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, great pick. Yeah, 52. I'm definitely gonna finish it, but it's everything I've read so far. You've nailed it, exactly what you said. Okay, next on my list, this is something that I will give credit to your show for getting me to read it, because you had the creator of or the writer of these books on your show, and I was. Never had any real interest to read it until I heard you guys talk about it. And I went out, I read these books, I bought all three of the complete collection, and I really loved them. And it took me down a rabbit hole, an X-Men rabbit hole, and that's Cable and Deadpool.
Ooh.
And Fabian Nicieza and Riley Brown and Patrick Zercher, I think, are the main people who worked on it for the most part. But it was originally called Cable and Deadpool, right? And then with the trades, they changed it to Deadpool and Cable, just in case of any confusion.
Yep.
But Deadpool is not a character that I ever cared for, and I almost on purpose was avoiding it just to like, nope, I'm not, you know, that's like Harley Quinn. It's just overexposed. They're just proliferating this character so much, I'm not going to like it. But I gave this book a chance because of how... Now, I'm not going to say sophisticated. I don't know if sophisticated is the right word, but there was a lot of layers to Fabian's story based on how you guys were talking about it. And it piqued my interest. And I cared a whole hell of a lot about Cable after reading those books, to the point where I went back into X-Men lore and just started reading everything that I could find on X-Men. So Deadpool and Cable, if you haven't read it, it's a lot of fun. It's got, I don't know, maybe you can describe it better than I could, but it's got action.
It's a funny comedy that isn't. I mean, like, you know, you have these two characters, you know, Cable and Deadpool, who have always been kind of linked anyway. Right. I mean, they appeared not that long apart from each other. Deadpool first appeared in X-Force. It was X-Force and New Mutants. New Mutants first. He was, you know, a constant kind of foil for X-Force, and he was around Siren a lot, but he was kind of this quirky character, and then he was really, I mean, Deadpool's breakout wasn't until Joe Kelly, you know, was writing. I mean, he had other breakouts, let's not, you know, kid ourselves. There was two other, you know, highly acclaimed miniseries. I think one of them had early Joe Matt art, but then where he really took off and really became the Deadpool we know today was by Joe Kelly, and he had a great run with the character, but then, you know, the character was not really doing much. They killed him off, and then they had replaced him with Agent X by Gail Simone, and then he was Deadpool again. And then you had Fabian Nicieza come along and say, you know, I contributed a lot to both these characters in the early goings. I'm going to do a story with them now, and he throws them together. They don't like each other, but, you know, they have at times begrudging respect for each other. And it's this really interesting chart of what I find so fascinating about some of these books, and this will come up with one of the ones I'm talking about in a minute, is that they take place in and around other events, even though they're not maybe at the crux of the event. So when you're reading something like Cable Deadpool, it's such a weird juncture of Marvel history that you're seeing this slice, and then you'll have characters jump in and out, and you're like, oh, this is happening during Civil War. Like, oh, this is happening. Oh, this is happening. This is what's happening with the X-Men at this time. Like, it's such a weird, it's a fun thing when you're reading an ongoing book that isn't part of the events, but still has, you know, plays in the aftermath of the events.
Yes.
And that's what this book was. And it's a great slice of, you know, what was going on for these two characters. And you don't need to know X-Men lore to really get it. Fabian gives you more than enough to go on. And he makes you care about Deadpool. Makes you care about Cable and their connection with each other. And, you know, near the end of the book, I mean, spoilers, but Cable, quote unquote, dies. And that impacts the book. And, you know, what Deadpool does next. And Fabian has a way of making you care about a character that, in your case, you didn't care at all, and suddenly you were invested.
And you know, you hear so often from when you listen to podcasts and people who are, you know, quote unquote comic book aficionados, the 90s are always this malign time, and, you know, the Liefeld characters are always made fun of, and Cable and Deadpool are two of those characters, but there's so much more to them, and this book plays with all of those tropes that you kind of know about, those things that people bring up to make fun of them, but it digs deep into who they are. As much as it's funny, as much as it's this buddy action film type of book, the stakes are so high, and you do feel very invested in the politics of it, in the philosophy of things that are happening, and I didn't expect that to happen with this book, while at the same time laughing and having a lot of fun. And like you said, it takes place during Civil War, and they tie into it, you know, they had to, but they do it in such a way that it doesn't really ruin the story, the narrative that Fabian was telling, but also takes what happened in Civil War and uses it to forward his story. It was just, I just thought it was brilliant. And I'm happy that I gave it a shot. It became one of my favorite series, and it led me down an X-Men path that I really, really enjoyed and has cost me a lot of money.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Go ahead. You take it away. Thank you for the assist on that as well.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, when we're done, I have so many alternates because I am not good at this. I'm not good at narrowing things down. So this is one I'm going to talk about. It's not meant to be a commercial for my show, but it's going to feel like it. So I apologize in advance. A book that I love, I've always loved, and recently went back and enjoyed it again. It's at the shortest end of our kind of rules here. It's 12 issues, but it's A Next. It's a book that I've always loved from the MC2 universe from the late 90s. It was originally done by Tom DeFalco and Ron Frenz. I have went to insane depths on this thing. I have always loved it, but I was able to somehow convince Ron Frenz to chat with me for, I think, over almost six hours just talking about these 12 issues, of which the last six I was able to rope in Tom DeFalco also as well to talk about it. It's a book about future Avengers, and what's so different about it is that, again, you have two very classic creators. So the book feels like an old school Marvel comic. You know, it doesn't feel like it's, you know, trying to be too cool or too hip or too dark or too edgy. It's just a, this is happens to be 15 years in the future of the Marvel Universe as of 1998. Let's go from there. What would it look like? And it's not trying to be out, you know, crazy out there, where, which I think a lot of people try to do these days. Like, you know, there's a reason why people love the Old Man Logan stuff, but it's all like desolate and depressing. Whereas this is just life and it's fun. And it's what does a future version of the Avengers look like if they broke up because something bad happened, but now you have, you know, through other confluence of events, a new team of Avengers comes together. What would that look like? And so, you know, it's not a surprise when you see the creators listed as Ron and Tom that, of course, one of the main characters is going to be Thunderstrike. In this case, the original Thunderstrike's son, taking up the mantle of his father, who is obviously a very important character to Tom and Ron. And then you have all these other characters that are, you know, such fun characters, like American Dream, who's, you know, kind of looks like Captain America, but she's, you know, this female, and she's very, she's our Captain America character, but she has different doubts. You have Mainframe, you have a version of Iron Man, but he's not really Iron Man. He's actually just a sophisticated artificial intelligence. You have J2, the son of the Juggernaut, which is one of my favorite stories, that it was created by accident, that the editor of the What If 105 thought that the Juggernaut, who was listed as being one of the Avengers there, thought it was a kid, didn't realize it was supposed to be the real Juggernaut. And so Tom just went with it and they just made him a kid. But like, so bizarre, and it's like this fun, weird, quirky team. So I love this book. It, every issue is a standalone for the most part, except for I think there's a 2-issue arc near the end, issues 10 and 11. But everything else, for the most part, it's just one issue. It's a full story. But you get subplots. You're moving the characters forward. You're getting a lot of content, and that's something I don't think you're getting a lot of in more modern comics. They're stylish and there's a lot more sophisticated themes, etc. But you're not also getting as much story compressed into as tight a space. Whereas when you're reading a Tom and Ron story, you're getting a lot. Like if you read a 10-page Tom and Ron story, a modern creator would make that one or two issues. Like you're getting so much wedged in there, but you never feel like you're missing anything. You never feel like there's not enough space. Anyways, I love these issues, issues A-Next 1 to 12. You can listen to my show, episode 744 and 748, where I go deep dive onto all these 12 issues, but they're so good. And, I mean, I already own them originally in the singles. I don't own the digest that has the 6 issues that they made back in, like, 99, 2000. I always kind of wish I did. I do own it digitally because I want to be able to go back and read it anytime. I read it to my son. He doesn't know anything. He doesn't, I mean, no offense to my son, but he doesn't have context for who these characters are, but he's still able to become invested in who they were. So he was loving Thunderstrike without ever knowing anything about the original Thunderstrike. He was just loving that character and loving the world that these two creators created. It's a singular vision. Well, not singular. It's a double vision, but you know, it's a vision that these two characters have, creators have. And one thing I learned talking to Ron, even before we did the commentary, was that he was a lot more involved with the plotting than he had been in any other project. So, you know, this is an artist who's already, you know, such a, you know, phenomenally talented artist, but he's also doing something that he's even more invested in because now he's even helping plot it more as opposed to prior projects. Not to say that he wasn't trying his hardest in everything else he'd done with Tom in the past, but this was even more investment from him.
Right. Well, if people are on a long plane ride, they can have 5 hours of you and Ron on your love fest for A-Next.
I love it so much. I was just like, yeah, I have to have it on here.
That's cool. No, fair enough. I mean, and your love as well as your what's the word? Not the director's cut, but your commentary on these books is proof positive of how much what high regard you hold it in. So that's definitely a fair choice. 100%.
Okay. I apologize as well. Right there, you might have heard some whispering. My son was in the room. For some reason, still awake. It's like 9:30 at night, and so he was just telling me that apparently my wife is having a secret drink party outside, which is technically true, but it's not a secret. I knew she was going outside to have some drinks with some neighbors, but apparently my son thought it was a big secret. He had to tell me, so I apologize in advance if you could hear his whispering, and you can totally cut this out.
No, no problem. I didn't hear him, but I think it's awesome that he felt the need to come and tell you that. the COVID police.
Yeah, I mean, there's less than 10 of them, so I think we're cool.
Yeah, you're fine. Don't worry. Since the lockdown that started in March, I started to read a lot more of my omnibus. I had a couple, not a couple, I had more than a couple, but it was the format that I was reading the least of, because it just didn't seem practical to pick up those books and read them quickly. But because I had a lot of downtime, I said, let me crack a couple of these open and give them a shot. So I started to really enjoy reading things in omnibus format, which is totally binging a whole, you know, 5 possible years worth of story. But one of the things that I finally read that I've always heard about and never really thought much of was a omnibus that contained mostly miniseries within it. And it was the main writer is a legend in the cosmic scope of writing comics, but a lot of the artists I wasn't quite as familiar with. And I said, I'm going to give this a shot because I hear really great things about it. And that's Annihilation.
Mm.
And Annihilation.
Can I quickly interrupt you? Sorry, I know you're in a great flow, but it's funny. I almost put on my list, not just that one, but like the entire DNA Cosmic Saga, because it's all in omnibuses, because I think there's, what, like 5 of them all together? So I thought about it, but I was like, that's too much.
Yeah.
But you're just putting Annihilation on, and that's cool.
Yeah, because I know Annihilation Conquest is next, and I'm going to pick that up when it's reprinted. And I've always heard people who are in the know, like I remember you talking about Annihilation and seeing some other YouTube shows where they speak very highly of this book, but it never seemed like it was the main thing happening in Marvel, but those who knew about it really appreciated what it was, the story it was telling. And it has these miniseries. This is before Guardians of the Galaxy was relaunched from DNA. But it has Drax the Destroyer miniseries, a Nova miniseries, Silver Surfer, Super Skrull, Ronin. I would never want to read these books, but reading them, like, just honestly, just on, like, I don't want to read 4 issues of Ronin. I don't want to read 4 issues of like the Super Skrull. Really, like, how good could that be? But the way that they are set up. Even when I was reading the Drax miniseries, which kicks off this book, I'm like, I don't know why this should matter to me. But as you continue reading this story and how they all kind of fit into each other story by story in a very roundabout way, but it perfectly blends together. By the time you get to the event of Annihilation, you're totally invested in the entire cosmic universe of Marvel. And it made me want to read a whole Nova series when I was done. Like, Nova really looked cool. And
it's so awesome. It's honestly so that good. Book is amazing.
Yeah, it's so good. And even the way that Thanos is used, and I'm blanking now on the main villain's name.
Annihilus.
Thank you. Annihilus, yeah. Annihilation. Annihilus. But and you take a lot of these characters who are typically super villains, some of the main villains for Marvel's, you know, most popular franchises, and you put them all together and you've got this ragtag team of B-list characters, if you will, and they just seem like the coolest thing ever. And I just love this book, and I'm really happy I gave it a chance. I recommend it to anybody who isn't, you know, is into the cosmic type of storytelling within comics. Give this a shot. It's the best way to read it is in omnibus form, for sure. It's a little pricey, but it's definitely going to be worth having on your shelf. You won't regret it. I don't think you'll regret it.
It's interesting. So I agree with you. I mean, it's great. And Nova really, for me, was the big revelation there, because like I never really cared much about Richard Rider. But after that book, I was like, I love Richard Rider. This guy's amazing. Mm-hmm. And the way that they, you know, bond that character with Worldmind, how interesting he is as kind of a wartime leader in the main Annihilation book once you get there. But I will say, once you do get your hands on the Annihilation Conquest on the bus, it is better. It succeeds. It's better. It's, you know, maybe not every piece of the other miniseries, but like the main thrust of it. Plus, a lot of what you're getting in that omnibus is going to be the first few issues of the Nova series, which is phenomenal and so good. It's got great artwork by Sean Chen, again, DNA writing it, and then you really get into it. And then, I mean, eventually you're going to have to buy these crazy War of Kings omnibuses to have the entirety, because once you get going, you're going to want it all. You're going to want to be able to finish it.
Yeah, that's the part that I'm scared of, because I have the Guardians of the Galaxy trades. I also have I've read the War of Kings, and I think the War of the Realms. That was Thor. What was the one that was tied in?
Realm of Kings
and the War of Kings. So I read those when I was reading the Guardians of the Galaxy trades, because those tie into those things so deeply, where the Guardians of the Galaxy doesn't really make sense if you're just reading those trades without the context of what's happening. So I'm scared that I'm going to end up buying all of those omnibus. But for now, Annihilation Conquest, I'm good. Don't do this to me, Adam.
You got to get them all, because, I mean, the amount of content in those books is ludicrous, because what you have to remember is that when you get up to the Realm of Kings and that kind of stuff, the War of Kings, is that you have to, if you just are reading the DNA stuff, you're not going to understand who the hell Vulcan is. And so you have to kind of go back. So what's nice about this omnibus is that, you know, it has X-Men Deadly Genesis. It has, what was it called? The Rise and Fall of the Shi'ar Empire, which is this 12-issue there's a year-long storyline in the Uncanny X-Men book all about going to space and what happens with Vulcan there. You need to understand all that. So, like, the omnibus is great because it kind of throws all that content in there.
That's
so cool. You're getting both sides, so you can really understand everything that was going on. It is ludicrous how much information is in there, but you get it all. And it's all, you know, in a nice, easy package. Maybe not easiest to read at times because there's so much. But again, if you were trying to hunt all this stuff down, it would take you forever. And it would cost a lot more money than just having them in one spot.
It's so funny you mentioned the Rise and Fall of the Shi'ar Empire, because I have it like right beside me as you said that, as well as the Deadly Genesis, which I had bought during my X-Men hunting of everything I could find X-Men. So I actually have those, and I'm like, oh, perfect. Like, those will give me the context I need.
they will definitely help, that's for sure. And yeah, so it's such a fascinating period from Annihilation forward to the end of the Thanos Imperative, that it is an amazing era, and it is to be enjoyed and ingested, and then when it's over, you should go back and start it again.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. And so, you know, everything else is not the same. Like, everything that came afterward, to me, was just not the same enjoyability. Like, it just started changing what the series was, and it changed what the characters were once you had, you know, Star-Lord and everything kind of brought back by Bendis, and it's just not the same. But, you know, I can't more aggressively tell you to read the entirety of the DNA period, but you can also not go wrong with starting with Annihilation.
Yeah. No, I really enjoyed it. I was happy with the purchase. I was worried at first. I'm like, am I going to like this? But I do really love the cosmic universe within Marvel, especially. I love all the Jim Starlin stuff that he's done, so I'm a sucker for anything cosmic. I know this isn't Starlin, but you definitely see little hints and nods to him in it.
Oh, for sure. I mean, something happens to Thanos that's pretty crazy.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
There's crazy shit all over the place. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, it was really good.
But it's interesting, now that I think about it, again, it's one of those things where it's such a weird, in particular, era of Marvel, because, you know, even the way Thanos is dressed, I'm sure you were like, what is going on with Thanos?
Yeah.
What is up with this creature on his shoulder? Like, did I miss something? Like, what is this?
Yeah.
It's different. And even with Drax, as you said, like, you know, if you just remember what Drax is now, you'd be like, oh yeah, he used to be ridiculous and be the giant and kind of hulkish and wearing a purple cape, and like, my son doesn't know what that is. It was an alternate costume in Marvel Ultimate Alliance 3, and he was like, I hate this. I'm like, Zach, that's what Drax looked like for like 30 years, you know? Like, he's like, oh, I hate this, it's stupid. And he just likes the one he knows, right?
Yeah,
he's just the more modern one, and that's where you get that Drax miniseries, where you give birth to that version. And the character of Cammy, who is still around. Like, she was recently featured in one of the Revenge of the Cosmic Ghost Rider books. Like, not where you'd expect to see Cammy, but she was there. She was also in Avengers Arena back in the day. And when I say back in the day, it's like 6 years ago, not even that long ago. But, you know, characters that were created here also ended up mattering as well. So it's such an interesting book.
Yeah, no, just flipping through it again as you're talking about it. It was it's bringing back. I don't have as good of a memory as you do. I forget things really quick. But even just the Silver Surfer miniseries and him fighting the different Heralds of Galactus and all of, like, how is this all going to tie in? And then in between all of the issues and miniseries, you've got like these pages that gives you so much content on the backstories of all the characters. I'm like, this is great, because whatever you're wondering, you get it answered. You get an idea of who these characters are, why they're important, or what their threat level is, and all this sort of stuff. So yeah, I really enjoyed that.
Nihilus. Oh yeah, the Silver Surfer book was fascinating, just to see. I can't remember if it was in that book or maybe it was in Annihilation, but just seeing all the shit that Galactus can do when he's unfettered, and like exploding, like, it's nuts.
Yeah, no, definitely.
That was a good pick.
What's next on your list?
All right. I'm going to go back to the late 90s because I love to live there. I got Mutant X, which is in a handy two-volume collection that you can easily buy. I think they're, what, $40 US each. It's covering the book by Howard Mackey, who hasn't really been around for a long time, but he used to be on a lot of books. He's written Spider-Man and certain X books, and then he was writing Mutant X. And Mutant X, it's interesting. X-Factor was supposed to have issue 150, and they kind of scrapped those plans and did Mutant X instead. And so you had X-Factor get up to issue 149. There's an explosion at the end. They think Havoc might be dead, and that's the end of the book. And then you pick up, you don't have another issue. You now have this new book called Mutant X. And Mutant X is a starring vehicle for Havoc, of all people. This is where I first came to, really love Havoc. And to be honest, he's never been written or given as much respect as he was here. Where he was, the headliner of his own book. He was trapped in an alternate reality from the explosion that he was in. There was this time traveling character trying to go back to his past or his future, his present, whatever. Anyways, Havoc kind of got caught in this explosion, and he ended up in a totally different reality. So he wakes up in it, and you go from there. So instead of waking up and it being his reality, wakes up in a very different world where he's a member of a team called the Six. He has team members like Madeline Pryor, who's actually his wife, also known as Marvel Woman. Here you have a version of Angel known as the Fallen, who's a more kind of creepy version of Angel. You have Storm, who's known as Bloodstorm here, because she never got over being infected by Dracula. You have Brute, who's a more kind of primitive version of Beast, he's devolved more and he's not really smart anymore. You have a crazy version of Iceman who got infected, or not infected. I forget what the storyline was in Asgard, but anyways, here he never really reverted back to normal, so he's always kind of stuck in ice form, and they're basically villains. Or kind of slightly villainous. And so Havoc has to, figure out what to do, how to, kind of survive in this new world, and how to hopefully eventually get back home. And his son in this reality knows that he's not really his dad, so he has to navigate that and figure out how to, become a hero and, turn against the Six and stop Madeline from becoming the Goblin Queen. And eventually, after that first year is done, they get to explore the rest of this weird, distorted version of the Marvel Universe. And it's really exciting and fun, and it's all about Havoc trying to find a way home.
That sounds cool. It's one of those books, I think, that can be forgotten in the mix because of all of the different X stuff that's happening. And I never think of Howard Mackey as doing anything X-Men related, but you've sang the praises of this book every time you bring it up, and it's nice to see that they collected it.
Oh yeah, I was actually quite shocked, but yeah, it's in these beautiful two trade paperbacks, and it's a really nice reproduction. It looks great. It's nice to kind of be able to enjoy it all, and some of it's silly and fun and very late 90s, early 2000s, but it's a great ride. It's a complete story, because it starts with him showing up in this alternate reality, and it ends with him leaving it, so you're not missing anything. And this is just a chapter in Havoc's story, and if you never read it, that's fine. You're not going to really miss anything per se. Unfortunately, no one ever references it, but if you do experience it, it's a really great done in one story, and you don't have to worry about what happened afterwards. This is the story. It's over now.
That's cool. Yeah, because I think sometimes we could get bogged down with whatever is going to happen next and whatever happened before that, but when you can read it, get into a story and just be invested in those 24 issues, if you will, and that's all you need to read, there's a satisfaction to that. And I think sometimes that could be the intimidating factor of getting into any of the mainstream books, because you feel like I've got to read 5 omnibuses like I do with Annihilation now. Whereas 2 complete collections it's neat and tidy, which is sometimes what you need.
Yeah, you know, like you came in with omnibuses, and I'm like, you know what? Let's make it simple. Let's not make it too hard.
Yeah, listen to Chapman's list. It'll cost you less money than mine.
One I did not end up, and I hope you're not about to say it, because then I don't want to take one away from you, but an honorable mention that I ended up not putting on my list, but I got damn close, in terms of this idea of kind of being a done-in-one story that, you know, you don't have to read it, but if you read it, you're really going to enjoy it, and then it's over, is Dan Slott's Silver Surfer, where it's a book where it's beautiful, it's so heartwarming, like really grabs you by the heartstrings, but when it's over, you don't feel like, you know, if no one ever references it ever again, it doesn't matter, because it happened, and it actually gives itself an out why we're never going to talk about it again, which is beautiful. And it's one of the best books I've probably read in the last decade. It's not on my list, but it was definitely high up there.
Well, it was the next one on my list, so thanks a lot, Adam.
No, I should have known.
No, you know, I was thinking about it, and I didn't include it because I thought you might mention it, but I 100% concur. And I have them all in, you know, collected trades, but that's one where when that omnibus comes back into print, that's a must have, because it's such a great story where you get the vision of the artists as well as the writer all the way through, which is so rare. But when you have those type of tomes where you have that sort of thing, like an Astonishing X-Men, it's, you know, I don't think there's anything much better than that in comics.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. Like, I've never read Doctor Who. I've never watched Doctor Who, but, you know, even I could kind of see similarities, in the very surface similarities. But, you know, when I was reading that book, which was interesting to me, reading it when the same time he's writing Spider-Man, it felt like, well, this one's the passion project. This is, you know, the other one's the one he's doing because he's writing Spider-Man, and that's fun. But it never felt like this is the book that meant everything to him. And maybe Spider-Man was that way to Dan Slott at the beginning when it was still fresh and new. But when you're on something for like 8 to 10 years, like, obviously it's going to be different. And some things are going to matter more to you than others. And whereas Silver Surfer always felt like an absolute passion project, something he cared so deeply about and really loved doing. And then you could feel like, and I've never been a huge fan of Allred, but like that made me love Allred. And people who I know who also have never liked Allred can't even conceive. They're like, how could you don't like this guy, how could you love Silver Surfer? I'm like, it's so good, and it's just so, you know, it's so heartfelt, and it's so wears its emotions on its sleeve. And yeah, some of it might be a little quote-unquote sillier, like naming the board To Me, but I like that touch, and I like the charming aspect. Like, it was, that's probably the best word for it. It was an absolutely charming book. It won me over with its charm, and a lot of that was also in Allred's art really was so charming and lovely. And the coloring too, like the color, I mean, I guess he had both Allred's working on it, but the colors were so beautiful, really bringing out the sweetness of every moment. I can't even look at I'm forgetting her name, but the companion, what she's wearing, like, it matters by the end. And I'm trying to dance around the ending of the book, but, you know, even what she's wearing and the colors, it means something. Everything means something here. And how often do you get that? And again, as you said, like, this is the vision of these creators working together on a project they love. And it feels like that love is just pouring through the pages.
Yeah. It wasn't a book that I ever thought I would read or enjoy. And when I was done with it, I literally, my mind was blown. It was so good. And like you, I didn't care at all for Mike Allred's art. I understood why some people would appreciate it, but it wasn't something I felt, you know, that's very stylized. It's very much a sort of niche type of look where you know who it is and what type of books they do. But it made me appreciate what he does and look at his work in a completely different way. And I'm so happy I gave that book a try. That's not on either of our lists, but it sounds like it is. So that just goes to show
you. Right?
So
that was just a bonus.
Yeah, definitely. Check that.
So what is the next one on your list?
Man, now it's getting tough, because when I thought I didn't have that many, I don't know what to finish off with. So
Hold on. Have we done 4 each or 5 each?
I'm on my 4th now.
Okay.
So this was something you referenced in the last episode of our binge-worthy comics, And since we last spoke, again, this is an omnibus, but this isn't a annihilation type of quest that you're going to end up on. This is a very easy thing to have on your shelf. You can read all the issues that are in it, and then at the end of it, you're good. You can walk away from it. And it has, the reason why I'm picking this is based on what we were just mentioning about that singular vision of writer-artist sort of collection. And it's a book that at times when I had read it before, and I hadn't revisited it for years until I had read it in its complete sort of story format, and that's The Ultimates from Mark Millar and Brian Hitch. And it's essentially what you get from the movie, the first movie. There's a lot of those things in the first half of this story that feels like it's from there. Of course, the Nick Fury connection, looking like Samuel L. Jackson, big, huge action scenes. But there was a lot of the book, these characters, the way that Mark Millar writes them, that made me not like them at all at first. And it made me keep reading it because for some reason, as unlikable as things were with the bureaucracy of S.H.I.E.L.D. and you know, the type of person that Cap was being characterized as, and just like this, the unlikability of these so-called heroes was so real because it was a post 9/11 world where it was being written from, and the cynicism and the, I don't know what it was, but it just felt like, oh, I don't like this version of Cap. But by the end of it, you really felt like this was a well-rounded, take me back to the, this was right, this was the Avengers in this Ultimate universe. And I really enjoyed, especially the second half. Ultimates 2 was even better than I expected it to be. It was so good. Were you going to say something?
Yeah, it's a great book. I find it, I don't know how well I can go back to read it, though, because it is so much of its time.
It's very much of its time. That I have
to say. It wears the 9/11 period on his sleeve. And
Very much.
You know, and again, it's interesting, too, because it was a period where the Avengers didn't sell. The Avengers weren't a popular thing, like, or at least that was the idea, right? That was Millar's kind of, that's why it's not called Ultimate Avengers. Is he thought that the name wasn't going to help. It wasn't going to make it better. It was going to bring it down, which I think Kurt Busiek would have taken umbrage at because he was writing the book at the time. But, you know, the Avengers were not what they are today. They weren't a franchise that you would build stuff out of anymore. Like, they were just like a main book, and yeah, its biggest leads had their own books, but that was it. And then you have this interpretation, which is so, again, at the time, trying to be very gritty and real. Like, it's so of its time. And then it's interesting because now the movies have shown that you can do a Captain America who is idealistic, and that's not stupid. And you don't, you know, I feel like so many of the decisions in Ultimates were done because they're like, well, that doesn't make sense, or that wouldn't really work, and maybe modern audiences wouldn't really buy that. And I feel like the MCU is kind of proving Ultimates wrong in a lot of ways, that you don't have to be that way. Yes. But it's hard not to still appreciate the Ultimates on a technical level. It's gorgeous. I mean, Hitch is obviously throwing everything he has into making this the best-looking book possible and really established a really core visual aesthetic for this book that kind of set it apart from the other Ultimate books, because this was the grounded one. This was the one that really felt real.
Yeah.
And, like, some of the action sequences are breathtaking. Like, you know, when you see the Avengers going up against the Hulk, like, this isn't, you know, Hulk just beating people up. Like, this is brutal. This is bones being broken. This is, you know, we got to do everything we can to, you know, stop this engine of destruction. This is what it would actually feel like to fight the Hulk. So there's so much good here. But it's also interesting how, you know, as you said, it's kind of dirty and dark it is as well. Like, you know, no one's perfect. No one's your idealized comic book character. But there are some mad, crazy shit that happens here. Like, there's, when you first get the, in Ultimates 2, when you're, I think it's Ultimates 2, or maybe it's Ultimates 1, I can't remember. When you first get introduced to Black Widow and Hawkeye, like, it's a, obviously very Matrix-esque kind of, action sequence. So very of the time, but still reads well, still looks awesome. In the second volume, when you have some brutal shit happen to Hawkeye, it looks amazing. Like, the art is not to be missed. It feels so cinematic. I guess the cynicism doesn't work for me anymore. I think it worked at the time. I think I maybe I'm just, you know, a happier or like want to believe in better things now. And the cynicism of the book is almost a little too much for me at times now, but it's hard to deny that it's an incredible read.
Yeah. And that's what I mean, where when I first started reading it, it was making me uncomfortable and I didn't have that good feeling of reading a so-called superhero book because it wasn't, right? These characters that are, they're more like damage control, it felt like, as opposed to they were a mess. But when you get into the second book, and this was the thing, what I appreciated from it was how much of the MCU is taken from here and how much of it isn't all at the same time, where they blend the beauty of what Bendis may have done with the Avengers, but also what Busick captures with the Avengers, and then a little bit of what this does, and all of those elements make up the MCU. But in this one, where the first one ends, and it seems so the cynical, the second one ends on a very high superhero emotional note, which I'm happy it did, because I was like, okay, when is this? These guys, you're right, very Matrix-esque feel. And very, like, everything was like, oh, that's what they're doing with Scarlet Witch and what's his name, Quicksilver. Like, okay, I've heard about this, and now I'm seeing it. And it's like, this was just being edgy everywhere it could possibly be edgy. But then, like you said, the surprises that come at the end. Like, this is the book where when I watch the MCU, I'm like, Hawkeye's not supposed to have a family. That's not Hawkeye the way he is in the Avengers. And actually, it is Hawkeye the way he is in this book. Like, that's where they got it from. I get it now. So having all of that context, I appreciate. And it was something that got better by the time I finished it. I'm like, that was good. I'm happy I stuck around for it, because there was a part of me like, I don't know if I want to read this right now, but I'm happy I stuck through it. So that's why I give it the binge-worthy stamp.
Okay.
All right, number five for you.
All right, so before I give my last one, I will give two quick honorable mentions. The first one is also available in complete collections, a two-volume set. You got the She-Hulk by Dan Slott, which is also coming out in Omnibus shortly. So that is a really, really, again, a charming look at the Marvel Universe. It's super fun. It's super nerdy. It goes a lot of different directions, but some of it is just like legal stuff. But you have, you know, Jennifer Walters also engaging in, you know, super heroics at the same time. You have using comic book precedents and like comic book issues as precedents in some of her cases. It's bonkers sometimes. It's fun. It's silly. It's immensely enjoyable. It has a great supporting cast that it made me love Awesome Andy, a version of the Awesome Android who became Awesome Andy, and he works at a law firm and he's awesome. He has a romance as well. John Jameson makes a number of appearances in the book. There's a new character named Pug who's a fantastic friend to Jennifer Walters. It's so much fun. So I highly recommend that. And my other alternate honorable mention is Spider-Woman by Dennis Hopeless, which is one of the weirder books in terms of how it started. Yeah, it started with, I think, four issues that were part of, Spider-Verse. And they were okay, but they were very, like, cheesy. And there, I think it was by Greg Land, and very typical to what you'd expect from him. And the story, like, was kind of not the greatest. It was part of the event, so it wasn't really allowed to kind of live on its own. And then you go from that to having this, you know, right when that's over, you have issue, I think, five of the series, and they go in a completely separate direction where suddenly they give Spider-Woman a whole new costume, and it's by Javier Rodriguez, and it's a totally different type of book, and she's a detective working with Ben Urich, and it's just fascinating. And the art is so cool and modern, and it's just, it feels like David Mazzucchelli's Love Child. Like, it has that kind of vibe to it. And then you're like, oh, this is good. And then it ends because, of course, I think it was like Secret Wars or something was happening, and it relaunches, and suddenly she's pregnant, she's about to have a baby, and it's like, all right, well, I guess let's see what happens. And it's somehow better. And then when she has the baby, it's better. And suddenly she's a single mom, but she's also got, you know, the support network of friends who are helping her raise this baby. It's such a charming, wonderful, quirky little book, and I wish it lasted longer.
I never finished reading Spider-Woman, but I did read up until the Hobgoblin trade. I did read all of that, and it was very good.
Oh my god, it got even better with the Hobgoblin stuff, because crazy shit happens. You're like, no, they didn't do that. But they did.
That was a very surprisingly good book, something you wouldn't expect to be as good as it was.
which I don't know why. Like, why can't Spider-Woman be quirky and weird and wonderful and awesome? But, you know, I guess we just didn't expect it. And maybe it's because of the way that previous Spider-Woman stories had been told, but suddenly it made you care about her whole world.
Yeah, and it goes to show, like, you can never write off a character because of the character. When the writer knows what they're doing and tells a good story and is left alone to tell the story, any character can become incredible. And
so that is a great lead into my actual pick.
Okay.
This is a recent complete collection I finally picked up. I'd been thinking about it for a while. It's a book I really loved at the time, but you know, sometimes you're like, oh, maybe I didn't love it as much as I thought I did. And so I bought it anyway, and I was knowing we were doing this episode, so I started reading it yesterday. I'm not quite done, but I'm getting there. And it's just as wonderful as I imagined, and I know it's going to get more heartbreaking near the end. And it's such a fantastic book. It's by a great writer who I'll segue for a second away from this. But one of the criteria when we were talking about binge-worthy, I was like, it has to be something where the run is over. Because there's a few things that I could have said, like ongoing books I might have selected. And Al Ewing's current run on Immortal Hulk would have been one of those, where it's absolutely binge-worthy, but it's not over yet. So I feel like it shouldn't be on that list until it's a complete run of some kind. But a book of his that is over, which did not really get maybe as long as it should have, is Loki, Agent of Asgard, which is such a weird... When you're talking about a book that exists within the raindrops of other books that were happening in the Marvel Universe at the time, this takes the cake for being the most bizarre. Because it is, you know, I think during the time that Jason Aaron has taken over writing Thor, but before Thor is unworthy, and then while the book is happening, you get to Original Sin. You have five issues where it's Original Sin 5.1 to 5.5, which is a big kind of connection to Original Sin. Then suddenly Thor doesn't have his hammer anymore. Then a few issues later, he doesn't even have his arm anymore, and now he's got the axe he's wielding. Like, so many weird stuff is happening around the Marvel Universe. Then Secret Wars happens at the same time. Like, the Marvel Universe is going bonkers while this book exists, and it's kind of jumping within the raindrops of all these other major events that's happening. And it reminds you how crazy the Marvel Universe is sometimes. But the book itself is absolutely phenomenal. If you've never read the Kid Loki run by Kieran Gillen on Journey into Mystery, this comes after that. Something bad happens to Kid Loki. Now we have a slightly older version of Loki. It's more of like a kind of teen heartthrob kind of Loki. But now he's an agent of Asgard, at least for a little while. He works for Asgard, Asgardia, actually, and he's doing some missions. But there's always something more to it. What this book created that I loved is a great supporting character named Verity Willis, who has such a fascinating origin. And when you get to it, you're like, no way. What? This is so crazy. But it's amazing. Like, I don't even want to spoil anything about this book because of how phenomenal it is. It's so expertly written. Al Ewing, I don't even know how he came up with this book. Like, the way he jumps back and forth in terms of, well, this is what you thought was happening, but this is what's really happening. And it all makes sense. It all jives. It's like a magic trick. He's really doing magic, and it's phenomenal. And I think I actually did talk about a lot of this with Al Ewing at some point on my show a few years ago, if you want to check that back out in my archives. But yeah, this book is just phenomenal. I don't know if you've ever read it.
No, I haven't read it.
It's crazy. It's weird. It's so charming. You really fall in love with this version of Loki. He's got something hanging over him that is really upsetting to him, and why he kind of pushes himself to be what he is. The book really, especially near the end, really delves deep into the whole nature of stories and of myth and what that means and what it means to be the god of story, the god of lies, the god of mischief. What does this all mean? I don't want to spoil anything because I do want you to read it, but it goes into such crazy directions. This Verity Willis character, you find this out very quickly about her, so it's not a huge spoiler. She's basically a human lie detector. No one can lie to her. She just knows the truth. She knows when people are lying to her. So what better person for her to then meet than Loki, someone who prides himself in being basically a liar, a trickster. But he can't lie to her because she'll know. And so they become best friends, and it's amazing. And there's other characters that are brought in here. one character who I never knew from anything else, but he had been used in Kieran Gillen's run. Others who had more of a longstanding use in Asgardian history at the Marvel Universe, but it's really something. It's special. It's not super long. It's got 17 issues of Loki, Agent of Asgard, plus the 5 issues from Original Sin. So you're getting like 22 issues in this one big trade. It's really, really good.
Cool. I would never have guessed that was the one that was going to top off your list. Very unexpected.
It's a surprise.
So you just recently bought that?
I just bought it. I read it when it first was coming out, so it wasn't a surprise to me. But I just recently finally actually picked it up. It had been kind of sitting in my wish list for a while. I'm like, no, I'm finally going to do this.
It is out of stock now on Amazon. I just checked.
And it's no, is it?
Yes, it is. And it's because of Chapman. Oh, man,
it must have just happened.
Yeah, all your fault.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is.
You ruined my Silver Surfer pick, and now I can't even pick up a Loki because of you.
Right?
Yeah.
So depressing. You know, it's funny. I think I actually bought it at Silver Snail this past week. So I finally saw it there. I was like, you know what? This is coming home with me.
There you go. Well, that's cool that you, just in time for the show, were able to reignite the love you had for a series that you may not have normally listed. That's kind of fun about doing these lists. It makes you revisit stuff. Like, do I actually remember that story? If I like it as much as I think I do, cool.
It's something I've come to love about comics more so in the last maybe 5 years than I did before. Is that I'm coming to really enjoy charming books that have a charm to them. The books that aren't just your most typical, I mean, I still like big superhero stuff, obviously, but, you know, there's something to the weirder, nicher kind of charming books like Loki, Agent of Asgard, like Spider-Woman, like, you know, She-Hulk. The books that are a little bit, Silver Surfer is another great example. Those are not straightforward superhero books in any stretch of the imagination. They are doing something different. And a lot of it is because you had a creator behind it who really loved the material and loved what they were doing with it. Like, as I said, even Al Ewing on Immortal Hulk right now, like, he loves what he's doing there. Like, he loves all the weird nooks and crannies that they're letting him do, making Hulk into a horror book and really going to town with it. And you can feel that on the page. You can feel when someone is super engaged, whereas when you're reading a book and, you know, they're having fun, but they're not as super dialed in, you can tell.
Right. Yeah, it's true. And sometimes when you get these type of offbeat books where you can kind of do what you want with it, you do see that creative freedom. Like, you think of things like Mr. Miracle or even The Vision from Tom King, right, where they're characters that people know, but you give them just enough space to tell the story they want to tell. Those stories suddenly become like these evergreen books that people, doesn't matter if you like comics or not, you're going to be attached to that book in some way, shape, or form. Even like Miss Marvel, here's another character where unexpectedly you love Kamala Khan and the universe that she inhabits. And there's that little bit of charm where the stakes aren't as high, but you're as invested in them because of your relatability to the character.
Absolutely. Oh, before you do unveil your big last pick here, the other one, which I'd be remiss if I didn't mention it as always being something high on my list, but somehow didn't quite make the list today, was Thunderbolts. And I think, I don't know where I would cut that off, probably just issues 1 to 75. That's kind of the original core run. But then there was New Thunderbolts that came after it, which was also great up until when Warren Ellis took over. But that's a book that I always would kind of sit down and love.
Okay, yeah, I got to finish that series. I have everything that is available in trade. But up to 75, I don't think you can even find that unless you buy it digitally. But on like Marvel Unlimited, it's not even there.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't even think it's available digitally. Like, I don't think they went that far.
Yeah.
I know that with the big trades, they went up to issue 50, which is still pretty good. Like, if you go up to 50 and you end it, it feels like a great place to stop if you had to. You know, like, it's I will always love issue 50. I told Fabian that. And I think he was kind of like, well, there was a lot going on, and I don't know if it worked. And I'm like, oh, it worked. Like, I loved every moment of that issue.
Yeah.
That's always a soft spot for me.
Okay, so for my final pick, it's something that I'm currently reading now and just about to finish. You can get it in various formats, whether it's complete collections, omnibus, whatever your fancy. You can get the two complete collections to have the whole series. You could have one Omnibus if you want that. And that's Uncanny X-Force from Rick Remender. It's a series that, out of all of the X titles, X-Force was the team that I was least interested in if I were to go back and collect Epic Collections or whatever the case may be. But this particular series from Remender, I like Remender as a writer. He does a lot of those, he has a lot of those tropes in his writing of dimension hopping and you know, time travel, but also a lot of philosophy and psychology that is added to it as well, which I enjoy. But this book takes this particular team of X-Force, of Wolverine, Psylocke, you've got Archangel, Deadpool, and Phantom X. A couple of those characters I couldn't care less about at the time when I first read this book. Like, this was the time where someone said, if you want to read Deadpool, but you can tolerate him, try Uncanny X-Force. It's really good. And then, of course, the first time I read this, I didn't have as much reference points for the significance of some of the things they were doing. But now, having read a little bit more of X history, there's still some things that I'm like, who's that again? Because it just, X-Men mythology is just way too dense sometimes. And I feel like my memory, there's only so much storage I have in it right now. But this book, rereading it again all in one sitting or without interrupting it with other stories, the second half is not as good as the first half in my opinion, but it's still very engaging and you do really care about these characters and this clandestine team of basically all mercenaries, like this secret team that Wolverine is on while he's simultaneously on the Avengers being the superhero. He's also this mercenary who will kill whoever he has to.
Did you ever read the X-Force that came right before this
from Christopher Yost?
Yeah.
No, I did not. I heard good things about it, but I never did.
That one was bonkers too. I mean, very different, and that one was in some ways more high octane action than even this one was. This one has a lot more, I would say, more thought behind it at times, whereas the X-Force was maybe a little bit more brutal. And the violence was definitely a lot more dialed up to the max. This one had a lot more kind of thought behind it, and definitely was more about, you know, characterization and trying to really put the characters through their paces. And I mean, obviously, it still told epics. I mean, you have the Dark Angel saga and everything. But I think for me, the low point of this book that kind of I always remember first, which is unfortunate, is the Otherworld storyline, because I never really liked that aspect.
I thought a lot of
the rest of it really sang.
Yeah, that was the part that I was in trying to get through, and I'm like, okay, I want to finish this because of the completionist in me, but the Otherworld stuff was a bit of a slog, and I'm like, and it was just the tone of the story as well as the artwork kind of took me out of where we had just come from. So it was like, that's why I say the second half, but after you get past those four issues, which is still serviceable story, it serves a purpose, but once you get past that, it kicks back into high gear where what was set up in the first portion of the story with the young Apocalypse and the whole Apocalypse issue that they are trying to prevent from happening throughout the story, it comes back in full swing. So I'm just in issue 31, 32, just about to finish the book. But it's one of those things where if you like the X-Men, this is something definitely worth owning and reading. And it has a rereadability to it because I had read the complete collection and I had forgotten everything. Rereading it now, I thought I knew the story, and I'm like, I do not remember so much of this, and I'm happy that I'm reading this again because it's paying off. So Rick Remender I was going to also mention Uncanny Avengers because it kind of has a somewhat of a similar tone to where he left this book off. He kind of picks it up there, it feels like. And it made me think of when you mentioned Mutant X and Havoc and him kind of taking the lead on a team and being like the main X character.
Right. He was big there too.
He was pretty big there too. And I really like that story. I know it didn't stick the landing with Access, but the journey that you take with Uncanny Avengers was a lot of fun. So I tip my hat off to Rick Remender. I like a lot of the stuff that he does. So that's my list. Those are the five. It's not as positive and happy as yours is, but that's why you're here to offset my cynicism.
You know, what's funny is that when you bring up Axis, so when I was reading, again, Loki, Age of Asgard, it's right during that period too, right? So that's what, again, it's so weird because, you know, it happens during Axis. So he gets inverted like everyone else. So it becomes like a superhero and ends up fighting, you know, the super villainous or debaucherous version of his brother. So, you know, it's interesting to see that you mentioned it because I forgot that was one of the events that it kind of has to play through while it's happening. So, it's a good reminder of how, again, as I said, weird the Marvel Universe is and what weird things it was doing at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's kind of fun to go back and just see where you were at when you read these stories for the first time, or even just where comics were, what was happening in the overall universe, because it just makes you think of other books that were also happening at that time. It's fun.
Well, it can be. It can also be severely, like, weird and, like, what is happening? Where am I?
Yeah, that's true. That happens to me a lot, too, because I'm bouncing from decade to decade when I read sometimes, and I'm like, okay, I know this is a reference to that, and I forgot where I read that now. So that happens too.
I mean, I think in some ways, I mean, I guess you're worse off because, I mean, I remember a lot of this stuff because I've read it before, or I know of it, and just I've just forgotten that it was happening. It must be even more disorienting if you didn't even know about it, and you're like, what is this?
Sometimes, like, the thing is, for a lot of these books, I was reading them for the, like, reading about these characters and getting to know things about them that I had never known before, but there were references that were kind of essential to my appreciation of what was happening, where I liked the story at the time. It was a lot of fun. The artwork was good, yada, yada, yada. But when I go back and read, you know, previous Spider-Man stories or previous X-Men stories, and sometimes they bring back stuff that takes place in, like, Claremont Burn era, you know, and it's like, oh, now I like this so much more now because I feel like I'm in on it, you know. So that's the part where rereading it and it feels like you're reading it for the first time, because you get the whole, like, in the case of the Uncanny X-Force, you understand the context of Warren Worthington's history with Apocalypse and all of the things that happened to him, you know. So the first time I read this, I didn't really get it. I knew peripherally, but I hadn't read the story to know what the character had gone through, the torture and everything. So this was it's fun to go back and you know, what's the point of having all these things on your shelf if they're just going to collect dust as trophies? Sometimes you got to pick those books up again and reread them, right?
I mean, I guess.
Yeah. it's a trophy room. That's really what it is.
I guess so. It's funny. Once in a while, my brother-in-law will be like, oh, man, I should have bought that Thor by JMS omnibus when I had the chance for $40 at that show, and I didn't. And then I was gone. I'm like, I haven't. I don't even care about it anymore, but I don't really want to sell it.
Yeah, it's so weird. It's
true. Even though I know he would, like, love to have it, I'm like, nah, I could just keep it.
Horrible, horrible man, Adam Chapman.
I know, but I do like it, but how often do I go back and read, like, a very specific run of Thor? Like, at least if you go back and read, like, the original, not original, but if you read Walt Simonson Thor, like, that's a huge, that's a Thor run, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It feels so much more classic, and so it feels like you can kind of jump in and enjoy it, whereas reading the JMS stuff, it's so specific. It's so specific to a specific period. And it's just harder to go back and read some of that stuff sometimes because it's so specific. I like something that feels a little bit more like, not typical or generic, but I can kind of go back to Walt Simonson Thor and feel like, oh, this is like a comfortable shoe. This is great. It's a great shoe, but it's comfortable. And maybe it's just because I like the old school aesthetic. I love old school comics. I like old school coloring. Like, I don't always want digital coloring. I like kind of the old four color style. Like, they had a story by Ron Frenz and Tom DeFalco in the it was the Thor If He'd Be Worthy one shot or whatever last year, the 80th anniversary one shots they did for each character, and they did one for Thor, and they did a classic Thunderstrike story, and the colors they used were like a very classic palette, and I loved it, and it really spoke to it, and it kind of made that story stand out much more than every other story in that volume, because this is the one that had more of a classic look to it. Yeah. And even the actually, speaking of Simonson, And it doesn't even have the original colors in the omnibus. Like, it's been recolored.
Yeah.
It's not the same as the original. It still has some of the essence of it, so it doesn't feel like you're, you know, reading something that's been so changed. But, you know, it's still, you know, that's one thing I've bugged me about some of the DC reprintings of different books and, like, the Tales of the Batman hardcovers, et cetera, is that the coloring doesn't quite look right. It looks a little too like they did something to it, and doesn't quite have that old feeling to it. And it kind of takes me out, because I want to be able to read an old school 70s Batman, 70s Superman. I want it to feel like 70s Superman or Batman. I don't want the coloring to not feel that way. Right. And I feel like if they tweak it, or they tweak it for the paper or whatever, I'm like, it's not the same. And now I'm not really getting the experience I want.
That's the cool thing about the Epic Collections, right? Is that it makes you feel that feeling of that era.
Yes.
A lot of the time, the paper feels like that, though, just the way the book feels and looks still, it still has that aura of I'm transported back to when this was made. As hokey as some of these concepts might be, there's something about these, like when you read, you know, I'm referencing X-Men a lot today, but I'm thinking of the Mutant
Genesis. Because the only book you like is X-Men. We get it.
That's it. No, I'm just thinking of Epic Collections and books that the age shows when you read that original Claremont run that came out in the Epic Collection. The age of the story shows. Like, comics like that, if someone were to make that today, it wouldn't be good. But when you read it and you put yourself back in that time, you can understand and appreciate how ahead of its time it was. You have to just take a moment to disconnect from what comics are now to really see how good those books were. And like you were mentioning with DeFalco and Friends, with A Next, it harkens back to that feeling you get from the way comics used to be made, where 2 issues could be, or 10 pages could be 2 issues, because you get so much in there. The way that they use real estate of the page, it you just get so, like I was reading recently Superman Exile Omnibus that you know, gave me the connect for that. So I appreciate it. I finished reading that omnibus finally. And I had read a lot of those stories before growing up. Those were my childhood comics. But there's so much happening in the world of Metropolis and in space, all in these books. So as Superman is exiled out of, you know, being guilt ridden. But the amount of character development that they were able to do, and granted, they were publishing 3 Superman books at the time per month, so you can get more story. But what's happening in those pages, you get a lot of your money's worth, and you kind of miss that.
I do. I miss it all the time.
Yeah, but that's why we do these lists. We can go back and reread those books and remind people of good stuff that they could read throughout different decades.
Like, we needed excuses, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, this was a lot of fun. I'm happy we got to do this again, and I already have a list for part 3.
Oh, my God.
All the stuff that I couldn't
I've already used up. I've already used up all my honorable mentions. You should write those down so that when we come back to this 2 years from now, I'd be like, okay, this is what you said last time, but these are your alternates.
I took your alternate of the alternates last time, and I used it for one of my picks this time. So there you go.
There we go.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for coming back to the show and spending this evening with us. It's the July long weekend that we recorded this, so happy long Wednesday, which is tomorrow, which the podcast will be out tomorrow.
Only in Canada, though.
Only in Canada, that's right. This is a Canadian production. What's coming up next for you on the podcast that people should stay tuned for?
Oof. I mean, at the moment, I have no idea, but that's kind of the fun. I'm recording with Dave Lanfear, so he's coming back to the show. He's a letterer. But other than that, not really sure what the future holds exactly. We're hoping to have some of our friends back on, but we're ramping up to episode 800, which is coming out on August 12th. That'll be the 8th anniversary of the show. It's hard to believe it's been going that long, but yeah, I gotta figure out how to. That's the only bad thing about doing a podcast, you know, weekly, is that, you know, you have to come up with content on a regular basis, and the minute you're done one, you have to get on to the next one. So that's both the fun and the challenge.
You've been doing a good job, though. 800 every year on August 12th. You're a freak.
Yep. You're welcome.
Well, I hope I can celebrate it with you again. I think I've been on the last 2 anniversary episodes.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it's always fun to have people on, and usually some of those episodes have been ridiculous. Like, they could be six episodes on their own. Like, I end up with a bunch of segments, and I don't know what I'm going to do this year or what kind of time I'm going to have to do it. But yeah, I plan on having you on the show again. And, we usually have Dan Gavazdin of the Amazing Spider Talk podcast usually comes on around. He's been on every anniversary episode since the third one. That's become kind of a regular thing that happens. So it'll be fun.
Very cool. Well, thank you again for episode 204 of The Cave of Solitude. And I look forward to our next chatting with Chapman.
Absolutely.
All right, dude. You have yourself a good night. Take care of those kitties. And we will talk soon.